When you hear of wars and disturbances, do not be terrified. For these things must take place first, but the end does not follow immediately. And he continued by saying to them, nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. And there will be great earthquakes and in various places plagues and famines. And there will be terrors and great signs from heaven. There will be signs in sun and moon and stars and on the earth dismay among the nations. In perplexity at the roaring of the sea and the waves, men fainting from fear. And the expectation of the things which are coming upon the world, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then you will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. But when you see these things take place, straighten up and lift up your heads, because your redemption is near. Then he told them a parable. Behold the fig tree and all the trees. As soon as they put forth leaves, you see it and know for yourselves that summer is now near. So you also, when you see these things happening, recognize that the kingdom of God is near. There is no doubt that the things going on over in Israel right now are absolutely terrible. The terrorist attacks of Hamas, the murdering of innocent lives, civilians, women, children, babies being brutally slaughtered, beheaded, put on display. It's terrible. But these events of late have certainly caught the attention of many. And even those who aren't looking at things from a spiritual perspective or a biblical perspective, a religious perspective, are saying this is not good, what's going on, you know. War is coming. Maybe even another world war is coming. And so there are many who are scared. There are many who are confused and uncertain of what, if any, significance these world events play in our lives and in our future. And I have heard a lot over this past week about recognizing the signs of the times, that the end is near. If you watch any amount of the news or things on social media, even if you just follow, I don't care probably what podcast you're following. Certainly if you're following any kind of religious podcasts or religious teacher, they are pointing to a lot of these things that are happening over in Israel right now and in the world at large. And they are crying out that the end is upon us. But many are suggesting that what we're seeing is the fulfillment of biblical prophecy right before our very eyes. And that begs the question, are we living in the end times? And what's interesting to me, as people make this claim and get all paranoid about what's going to happen next, the words that they point to prop up or to substantiate their ideology, the way that they're thinking about things, is this very teaching that we've just read from Jesus. I read to you from Luke's account in Luke chapter 21. But Matthew chapter 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21 all have an account of Jesus' conversation with his disciples where he outlines some of these very things. And if you're like me, you're no doubt going to get into conversations with folks who have questions about the end times. They're going to refer to things like the Great Tribulation and what's your position on the rapture? Do you think there is going to be one? What about the millennial reign of Christ? Is it pre-trib? Is it post-trib? Are you a premillennialist? Are you an amillennialist? What about the restoration of Israel and the throne of David? How are we going to respond to those questions? Do we even know what they're talking about? This morning, I'm not going to answer all of those questions related to this topic, but I do want to look at one particular passage, which is often at the heart of some of these, what I believe are erroneous teachings and theologies, that we might be a little better equipped to give an answer when people come up and ask us, do you think you're living in the end times that Jesus talked about in Matthew chapter 24? So what I'd like to do is read through this text together. I'm going to read it rather quickly for the sake of time. And then we'll come back and make some observations so that not only will we be able to better answer those who have questions about are we living in the end times that Jesus talked about here, but also if you're struggling with fear or doubt or concern about the times in which you're living, perhaps I'll help you to be able to settle some of those things in your own mind about those issues. So if you will, begin with me in Matthew chapter 24 and verse 1. Jesus came out from the temple and was going away when his disciples came up to point out the temple buildings to him. And he said to them, "Do you see all these things? Truly I say to you, not one stone here will be left upon another which will not be torn down." And as he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, "Tell us, when will these things happen? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" And Jesus answered and said to them, "See to it that no one misleads you. For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and will mislead many. You'll be hearing of wars and rumors of wars. See that you're not frightened, for those things must take place, but that's not yet the end. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and in various places there will be famines and earthquakes, but all these things are merely the beginning of birth pangs. Then they will deliver you to tribulation and will kill you, and you will be hated by all the nations because of my name. And at that time, many will fall away and will betray one another and hate one another. Many false prophets will arise and mislead many. Because lawlessness is increased, most people's love will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end, he'll be saved. This gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all the nations, and then the end will come. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains. Whoever is on the housetop must not go down to get the things that are out, that are in his house, and whoever is in the field must not turn back to get his cloak. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days. And pray that your flight will not be in the winter or on a Sabbath, for then there will be a great tribulation, such as has not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever will. Unless those days had been cut short, no life would have been saved, but for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. Then if anyone says to you, 'Behold, here is the Christ,' or 'There he is,' do not believe him. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and will show great signs and wonders, so as to mislead, if possible, even the elect. Behold, I've told you in advance. So if they say to you, 'Behold, he's in the wilderness,' do not go out. Or, 'Behold, he's in the inner rooms,' do not believe them. For just as the lightning comes from the east and flashes even to the west, so will the coming of the Son of Man be. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. But immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. And he will send forth his angels with a great trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other. Now learn the parable of the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. So you too, when you see all these things, recognize that he is near, right at the door. Truly, I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. But of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son of God, but the Father alone. For the coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark. And they did not understand until the flood came and took them all away. So will the coming of the Son of Man be. Then there will be two men in the field. One will be taken, one will be left. There will be two women grinding at the mill. One will be taken, one will be left. Therefore, be on the alert, for you do not know which day your Lord is coming. Be sure of this, that if the head of the house had known at what time of night the thief was coming, he would have been on the alert and would have not allowed him to have his house broken into. For this reason, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming in an hour when you do not think that he will." That's enough. We can stop there in our reading. A lot of people have seized on these words of Jesus and seen in the prophecy that he is relating here a reference to the end of time, the last days, the final judgment, or what we might refer to as the Lord's final return. Many have been investigating the signs, looking for these signs that are given here. The wars and the rumors of wars and the earthquakes and the famines and the sun not giving its light and the moon turning to blood and the stars falling from heaven and all of this kind of stuff. Trying to decipher when are these things going to happen so that they'll be ready for the Lord's return. But let me suggest to you this morning that there's a rather simple explanation. These words of Jesus, at least most of them that we've just read, have nothing to do with the end of time, have nothing to do with the final judgment or the end of the world, but something else, something much more local, something that's already happened from our perspective today. Let me share with you some reasons why I don't believe that this passage, these words of Jesus, are talking about events that from our perspective have not yet transpired. There are so many things within the text itself here that would contradict the idea that what Jesus is telling his disciples about is the end of the world. Notice how this discussion began in chapter 24 and in verse 1. They're coming out of the temple. They're getting ready to go out of Jerusalem, down the Kidron Valley, and up to the Mount of Olives, which was an opposing hill. From the east of Jerusalem, you could look back on Jerusalem and see the Temple Mount and the temple and all of the glory of the city. And this is the perspective. They're walking out and they're looking at the temple buildings, and his disciples are pointing those out to him. And he says to them, "You see all of these things? The temple here and all of its surrounding buildings, not one stone will be left upon another. It's all going to be torn down." And they get over to the Mount of Olives and they're looking back at the city of Jerusalem, this magnificent structure. And the disciples want to know, "Lord, can you tell us when will these things happen? What are these things?" It's a reference to what Jesus just told them, the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. And they say, "When will these things happen? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" You can look in Mark chapter 13. You can look in Luke chapter 21. The context in both of those passages is the same. The response that Jesus gives is answering the question of when is the temple going to be destroyed? Now, where some confusion may come in is the fact that here the disciples say, "When is the temple going to be destroyed? What's going to be the sign of your coming and the end of the age?" And let me suggest to you, the disciples, when they asked the end of the age here, they may have been thinking the end of time, the final judgment. Because perhaps in their mind, they just assumed that the temple, God's house, would certainly stand until the end of time. If that is true, that certainly is not the first, nor will it be the last time that Jesus' 12 disciples have some misconceptions and misunderstandings about the messianic kingdom. They thought Jesus was going to reestablish an earthly kingdom. He says, "No, that's not what I'm doing." It's not outside the realm of possibility to think that they were under the impression that the temple would last until the end of time. So in their mind, Jesus says it's going to be destroyed one day. Well, that must be at the end of time, so Lord. So when is that going to happen? Tell us, what are the signs of your coming and the end of the age? That may also explain why Jesus answers both of these questions in the section. He gives them information about when the temple will be destroyed and then also about his final coming towards the end of this chapter. But we'll talk about that more a little bit later. There's also this reference here about the abomination of desolation that we read about in verse 15 of Matthew chapter 24. And there's been some question about, well, what is this a reference to? It's interesting, if you turn over in Luke's account, in Luke chapter 21, Luke seems to draw the correlation here that this abomination of desolation, which is some language that's borrowed from the book of Daniel about a time from Daniel's perspective that was yet coming, where Jerusalem was going to be surrounded, the abomination of desolation was going to be where it should not be. Luke says in Luke chapter 21 and verse 20, "But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her desolation is near." And so this abomination, something that's abominable, is something that is not pleasing to God. And certainly, Gentile armies would not be pleasing to God because they have their own agenda, their own plans. Though God can sometimes use them to fulfill his purposes, they're not fighting for God. And here, this idea of making something desolate is destroying it. And Daniel prophesied that something was going to come and do something to the Temple Mount. It was an abomination, something that was unholy, that was going to defile the temple, the sanctuary of God, and make it desolate, destroy it. Luke identifies that as these foreign armies that are going to surround Jerusalem. Daniel, on his part, if we were to go back to Daniel chapter 11 and chapter 12, we would see that Daniel associates the abomination of desolation with the ending of the regular sacrifice. That when the abomination comes, you're no longer going to be able to offer the sacrifices at the temple as was ordered under the law of Moses. And what we're going to ultimately see is that I believe that's an allusion to the coming of the Roman armies in AD 70 under Titus, who would surround the city and besiege it, and ultimately would break in and destroy the temple, burning it to the ground, tearing every stone from the other, destroying the altars, and putting an end to the regular sacrifice that the Jews were supposed to do under the law of Moses, thus bringing about an end of temple worship. And you know what's interesting about that destruction in AD 70? Is that from that day on until our day, there has been no temple. There has been no regular sacrifice offered by the Jews according to the law of Moses. But ultimately, the clearest thing to me that makes me certain that what Jesus is talking about here in Matthew chapter 24 is not a reference to something that has yet to happen from our perspective is his simple statement in verse 34. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. So everything that Jesus has mentioned from verse 5 or verse 4 on down through verse 33, all of those things were going to take place within the lifetime, the generation of those that he was speaking to on that day. Not 2,000 years later. Or however long it's going to be until the Lord's return. He's talking about things in this section that are regarding things that would happen in that generation's lifetime. And so all of this, wars and rumors of wars and famine and earthquakes and the blood moon and the stars falling from heaven and people being distressed and people being afflicted and this great tribulation that he talks about and abomination of desolation, all of that stuff is mentioned in that section. And Jesus says all of those things are going to happen before this generation passes away. So I can say with certainty that all of those things have already happened. He's not talking about some future end times prophecy here. But there are some further observations that I think help us to see that at least verses 1 through 34 are not about the final return of the Lord or the end times or the final judgment. And I'll address these as objections that people point to say, well, no, see, it says this in here, so that hasn't happened yet, so this can't be. Jesus must have gotten it wrong there in verse 34 when he said these things are all going to happen in this generation. And one of the things that's pointed to is what's referenced in verse 14 where it says, this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all the nations, and then the end will come. And people say, see, it hasn't happened yet, because the gospel hasn't gone to every person in every nation throughout the whole world. I'm sure there's still some uncivilized people out in the backwoods of the Amazon jungle that haven't heard the gospel yet. So the gospel hasn't gone everywhere. So this can't have happened. Well, let me suggest to you that when people say things like that, they disagree with the inspired Apostle Paul, who wrote to the Colossians in about AD 61-62. In Colossians chapter 1 and verse 23, we read this observation made by the apostle. An observation that is inspired by God, and so therefore we can be confident that it's true. He says in verse 23, "If indeed you continue in the faith, firmly established and steadfast, and not moved away from the hope of the gospel that you have heard, which was, past tense, proclaimed in all creation under heaven, and of which I, Paul, was made a minister." When Paul wrote that in AD 62 at the latest, he was under the impression, through inspiration again, so he can't be wrong, that the gospel has already been proclaimed throughout all creation. Well, isn't that exactly what Jesus would happen? Said, isn't that exactly what Jesus said would happen before the end of the temple age would come? Absolutely. Isn't AD 62 before AD 70? Yes, your math is correct. It happened. Who's heard the term the Great Tribulation? It's a term that's thrown around a lot. It's oftentimes associated with all sorts of various flavors of some sort of millennial dispensationalism, this idea that Christ is going to come down and reign on earth on a literal throne for 1,000 years before the end comes. And you know, there's this great tribulation that everybody's talking about. Some say the tribulation is going to come before the rapture. Some say it's going to come after the rapture. Some say that Christ's reign will be before the tribulation, and then the tribulation comes after. There's all sorts of conjecture and ideas and thoughts on that. I would suggest to you one of the reasons why there's so many conflicting ideas about that is because nobody knows what they're talking about. Okay? It's things that we've all, that man has made up. Things that have been read into the text that aren't there. But this idea that there's going to be a great tribulation, one that has, like, nothing that's ever happened before and is never going to happen after it, that comes from here in Matthew chapter 24 and in verse 21. "For then there will be a great tribulation, such as not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever will." And so people say every year something worse happens somewhere. And so that this great tribulation can't have occurred yet. Well, let me suggest to you that sometimes prophetic language uses a turn of phrase that we call hyperbole. An over-exaggeration of facts. Okay, it's not to be taken literal. But what's interesting to me is that the Jews in and around Jerusalem, just prior to and leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem, the destruction of the temple in AD 70 under the leadership of Titus, was indeed a very tumultuous time for the Jews. And for the people that live specifically in Jerusalem. You go back and read in Josephus and his histories the terrible atrocities that were happening in and around Jerusalem in the years leading up to the destruction of the temple by the Romans. What's interesting to me is going back all the way to the mid-40s, we have the Jews who began to rebel against Roman oppression. And there was an uprising here and an uprising there and a little revolt down here and a little revolt down there. And news of those things would trickle into Jerusalem. And Jesus said, when you hear of wars and rumors of wars, don't be deceived. The end is not yet come. Those things are going to proceed. Right? And when the Romans finally had enough of these Jews kind of attacking this Roman garrison and that Roman garrison and declaring this city independent of Rome, they said, you know what, enough of this. We're sending the army and we're going to squash this rebellion. And so at the time he was commander of the armies. Nero was the emperor, but Vespasian came in bringing in an army. And he starts capturing city after city after city in Palestine, setting his sights on Jerusalem. And that's the next city that he's getting ready to capture in 68 AD when word reaches his ear that Nero has died. And now the empire is in turmoil because who's going to be the new leader? Well, Vespasian ultimately makes a play for that spot. He gets it. But that caused a great delay in him actually going to Jerusalem and putting it under a full siege. Ultimately, Vespasian wouldn't be the one who'd do it. He'd send his son Titus as commander of his army now to besiege Jerusalem in AD 70. But what's interesting is during that time, not only were the Jews being threatened from the outward enemy of the Romans, but there was so much internal conflict going on within the city of Jerusalem itself. There was actually a civil war going on inside the walls of Jerusalem. You had at least three factions of the Jews that were fighting against each other. And so it was a danger to just go out into the streets and conduct business because one of your enemies might kill you. And when Titus finally did come back and surround the city, you had now trapped in the city these three warring factions of the Jews. So you have a war going on inside the city and a war going on outside the city. And to make matters worse, they experienced a famine, which means now they're running out of food. And they resorted to all sorts of terrible things like eating their own children in order to survive. And rich people, they would try to flee from the city, and they were so afraid of being robbed on their way out that they would eat their gold so that they could flee from the city and then they would get it later. But when the robbers found out about that, they said, well, we're going to check everywhere. And they started cutting people open and ripping the gold out of their stomachs. You want to talk about some serious hard times, like stuff that had never occurred up until then and probably going to occur after that. I'm telling you, go back and read Josephus and his description of the atrocities that are going on within the city of Jerusalem during this time period. It's not a stretch that that's the great tribulation that Jesus is referring to here. What's really interesting to me as I was rereading Josephus last night is that there came a point in the siege when Jerusalem was surrounded by the Roman armies that Titus said, you know what? Instead of trying to take the city by force, let's reason with them. Let's see if they'll surrender peacefully. And he gave anybody in the city who wanted to leave an opportunity to leave. They could come and defect to the Romans, or they could go wherever they wanted as long as they didn't put up any resistance to Rome. And wasn't it that Jesus said, when you see the abomination of desolation, the armies surrounding Jerusalem, that's when you're supposed to flee? And isn't it interesting that during the siege, Titus gave anybody who wanted to the opportunity to get out of Jerusalem? And if you were the reader who understands, you would have said, this is the time. Now is our chance. Let's get out now. The other thing that's often pointed to is the sun not shining, the moon turning to blood, the stars falling from heaven, the powers of heaven being shaken, and all of this kind of stuff, and saying, this is stuff that doesn't happen on a regular basis. This is end time stuff. This is stuff that only is going to happen at the end when God comes back and destroys everything. But what's interesting to me is that that kind of apocalyptic or judgment language is not unique to Jesus' teaching here in the Gospels. In fact, we can go back and read. We're not going to take the time. We could read in Jeremiah how Jeremiah uses that same language to describe the fact that God is going to use Babylon to come in and destroy Jerusalem and destroy the temple and carry the people away into captivity. And he talks about the sun and the moon and the stars not giving their light. He talks about the heavens being shaken. Isaiah will turn around and use that same kind of language to talk about the judgment God will bring upon Babylon after they've punished Israel. And then Ezekiel will use the same language to talk about judgment that God's going to bring upon the nation of Egypt. And I'm not guessing in those texts that this is what's being referred to. The text specifically tells us this is a prophecy about the destruction of Babylon. And this is the language that it uses. This is a destruction of Egypt, and this is the language that it uses. Okay, so I'm not guessing at what nations are under consideration in those prophecies. The writer clearly tells us, and he uses the same language that Jesus uses here. And the reason why is because that is judgment type language. And God was going to bring a judgment against Jerusalem in AD 70, and he was going to put an end to temple worship because no longer were we going to be saved through the law of Moses, but through Jesus Christ, his Son. And finally, there is a transition in the text. It occurs in verse 35, where Jesus says, "Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away." I think Jesus utters that statement to reassure his disciples that they can be confident that everything that I've just told you is going to happen. It is going to come to pass. Okay? So you can be confident. There's going to come a time when heaven and earth will pass away, but what I just told you, that's not going to be done away with. And that's what Jesus pivots on right there. He said, now that I've brought up this idea of heaven and earth passing away, let me tell you about that time. And isn't it interesting that he tells us about the timing of that event? But of that day and hour, no one knows. Not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone. He goes on, he says, it's going to be like the days of Noah. Right? In the days of Noah, they were apparently oblivious. They were just going about life as normal because everything was routine. There was no great sign that said something was going to happen until it happened. It took them by surprise. Jesus is saying, in the end, that's how it's going to be. Which tells me everything he's told us before can't be in reference to the end, because he's been saying up until this point, look at the signs, decipher the times, you'll be able to tell when it's coming. But in the end, you're not going to be able to tell. You're not going to know. And that, I think, is the ultimate point, guys, is that we don't know when the end is going to come. We have no way of being able to tell. The only thing we know is that it is going to come. Therefore, Scripture is clear. Be on the alert. Be ready, because you do not know the day or the hour. Let's close by reading one passage together that is relevant to this question. It's in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, beginning in verse 1. The Apostle Paul says, "Now as to the times and the epochs, brethren, you have no need of anything to be written to you. As to the end of time, the final judgment, when that's going to happen, you don't need me to write anything to you. Why? For you yourselves know full well that the day of the Lord will come just like a thief in the night. While they're saying peace and safety, then destruction will come upon them suddenly like labor pains upon a woman with child, and they will not escape. But you, brethren, are not in darkness that the day would overtake you like a thief. For you are all sons of light and sons of day. We are not of the night nor of darkness. So then let us not sleep as others do, but let us be alert and sober. For those who sleep do their sleeping at night, and those who get drunk at night. But since we are of the day, let us be sober, having put on the breastplate of faith and love, and as a helmet the hope of salvation. For God has not destined us for wrath, but for obtaining salvation through our Lord Jesus Christ, who died for us, so that whether we're awake or asleep, we will live together with him. Therefore, encourage one another and build one another up, just as you are doing." Paul's point here is, you don't know when the end's going to come, but it doesn't have to take you by surprise, because you can be ready in the blood of Jesus. You can be ready to meet your Maker, having been washed clean in the blood of the Lamb. And I can't think of anything more encouraging than that idea. That I don't have to worry. I don't have to be obsessed with trying to figure out when is the end going to come. I just need to worry about living every day for the Lord.